Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Genesis chapter 22, the whole chapter, verses 1 through 24, the sacrifice of Isaac. Our context is this. In our last chapter, we had Isaac being born, then we had Ishmael being kicked out into the wilderness and God protecting his mother Hagar and himself, and then we have Abraham signing a treaty, making a covenant with his old friend Abimelech of Gerar, the same Abimelech who unfortunately ended up with Sarah in his harem in a previous chapter. And so now we turn to Genesis 22 verse 1. Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, Here I am. Now it came about after what? It came about after what things? Well, after Isaac had time to grow up and to be a young man, because in our previous chapter, it was at the weaning festival of Isaac that Ishmael made fun of either Isaac or somebody, either Ishmael or his mother Hagar, perhaps joined into it. And there was family dissension, and God and Sarah said, You need to kick this guy out. And God said, Yes. And so Abraham kicked Ishmael and Hagar out of the house. That was when Isaac was weaned. And so now it's sometime after that. Now, how long after that is a matter of conjecture, and people disagree. The NIV Study Bible says that Isaac had time to grow up to be a young man. How do we know that? Well, he carried a load of firewood up Mount Moriah here in this chapter, so at least he's a young man. Here's what GotQuestions.org has to say on the issue of how old Isaac was. First of all, Sarah gave birth to Isaac when she was 90 years old. We know that from Genesis 17:17. Sarah sent Ishmael away after Isaac was weaned. That was in the last chapter, as I just said. Weaning usually took place between the ages of 2 and 5, let's say 3. Then Sarah died sometime after Abraham's attempted sacrifice of Isaac on Mount Moriah. She died at the age of 127. And at that time, we can do the math because we know how old she was when Isaac was born. She was 90 when Isaac was born. If she died at 127, that means Isaac was either 36, 37 years old when Sarah died. And since Sarah is mentioned after the incident at Mount Moriah when Isaac was almost sacrificed, that means Isaac has got to be younger than 36 or 37 when he's on Mount Moriah. He's got to be older than 3 when he's weaned in chapter 21. He's got to be younger than when Sarah died when he was 36 or 37, somewhere in between there. Now, the phrase a long time in Genesis 21:34, that came about after these things, or as the NIV says, well, actually it's in verse 34, Abraham sojourned in the land of Philistines for many days after a long time. That was in the previous chapter. He stayed there, the land of the Philistines. That's a proleptic reference to Gerar, which is in the land of the Philistines, but the Philistines didn't show up for another 400 years or so. So Moses mentions the land of the Philistines. That was many days Abraham stayed there. So we know that Isaac was weaned, and after that, Abraham stayed there for a long time. He was weaned at 3 years old. So let's just say he's about in his teens. We know he's not a toddler because he traveled the 3 or 4 day journey from Beersheba, which is where Abraham is now, up to Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. That's 45 miles. And a little baby doesn't go with a 100-year-old father by himself up to Mount Moriah. So he was probably a teenager. He had to care for himself as well as his father on the trip. And he also carried firewood up Mount Moriah. And a little baby doesn't do that, or a little toddler doesn't do that. And it was enough wood to sacrifice a human, so it was not a light load. So he's got to be at least a teenager, if not a young man. Now, I just said that Abraham is still in Beersheba. He left Gerar and went to Beersheba. We know that. We assume that Abraham is still in Beersheba. How do we know that? Adam Barnes says he's in Beersheba. But we also can look at Genesis 22, verse 19 in this chapter. Abraham went back to his young men after taking Isaac up on Mount Moriah, and they got up and went together to Beersheba. And Abraham settled in Beersheba, so he went back to Beersheba, I'm assuming, and he left from Beersheba. Now, it says in verse 1 that God tested Abraham. Now, this word test has no connotation of tempting to evil. The Old English translation of tempt is misleading. The Greek word for test can either be translated tested or tempt. One means to seduce to evil, tempt, like Jesus was tempted in the wilderness. Tested just means you try something to see whether you can pass the test. For example, I give you an algebra test to see if you know any algebra. And that's the sense here, is God is testing Abraham, not to seduce him to evil, but to see if he passes the test of faith. We have the same problem in English. that's in Chinese. The Chinese word shirtan has exactly the same problem. It can be translated into English. And in Chinese, it either means to tempt to evil or it means to test to approve. Well, here it means to test to prove. For example, as in 1 Peter 1:7, so that the proof of your faith being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire. So you take gold, you test it to prove whether it's true gold or not. Likewise, Abraham was having his faith tested to see if it was solid gold. Now, God tested Abraham. If you think about the meaning of the word Abraham, it's kind of ironic here. Abraham means the father of many nations. God had promised him that, as you know, Genesis 17:5, no longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I've made you the father of a multitude of nations. And I hear Abraham is about to kill his firstborn son, who it is necessary to have alive if you're going to have a multitude of offspring coming from your loins. And Abraham's about to kill him. Now, this is a severe test, obviously, a severe test of his faith, a horrendous test. Now, it says that God spoke to Abraham. God tested Abraham and said to him. How did he say to him? Well, again, we don't know. Could be a dream. Could be a night vision. The reason I say that, verse 3, Abraham said Abraham got up the next morning, so it was at night probably that God spoke to him, either in a dream or a vision. We go to Genesis 22, verse 2. He said, God said, take now your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. Your only son. Now, actually, Abraham had two sons. He had Ishmael by Hagar and Isaac by Sarah. But here, God means your only son of the covenant. He's not counting Ishmael, the son by the concubine. He's talking about an only son by his wife, because that's where the seed was coming from his wife. So your only son whom you love. And it seems like here God is doing everything to point out to Abraham what he was about to lose. You're about to lose it all, Abraham. This is a severe test and application. I can't help but make an application here. How many times has God asked you to give up something you love to show that you are more dedicated to God than you are to the bonds of this earth? The things that grab you like claws and hold you down to the earth, are you willing to let go? And God said, you willing to let go of your only son, because there's not another one to replace him. Sarah was very old when she had that miraculous birth of Isaac. She's not going to have another one. You willing to let him go? And you love him. You willing to do what I say to you? You willing to kill him? Jesus also has a severe request for discipleship. In Luke 14:26, he says this, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. You going to let your kids go when they follow the world and you don't? Your brothers and sisters, your mother, your wife, your father? That's the way it is, folks. I wish it wasn't. But sometimes you have to make a choice. You cannot go with natural relations if it gets in the way of your relationship with Jesus Christ. Now, Abraham had just been through 25 years of waiting and all the trials of faith that Abraham had gone through just to even have Isaac. And now God's asking him to give Isaac up. The promise to have descendants was given to Abraham at age 75 upon leaving Haran to go into the promised land. Isaac was born at the age of 100, so he had to wait 25 years before the baby was even born. And now God's saying, give him up. Abraham is told to go to Mount Moriah. We know this is the Temple Mount, the mount where the Jerusalem temple was eventually built upon. 2 Chronicles 3:1, then Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to his father David, at the place that David had prepared on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. And that's where later, about 900 years or so later, Solomon built that temple. And David and God appeared to David at the threshing floor where the temple was built right before Solomon. So this is a famous place, Mount Moriah. Now notice the passage does not actually say that Isaac was sacrificed on the place where the temple was built. He was supposed to go to the land of Moriah and there on one of the mountains of which I tell you. So we don't know for sure it was the exact same mountain where the temple was built, but it was in the same area at least. Now this threshing floor where the temple was built is now where the Muslim mosque Dome of the Rock is built. It's there now. It's run by the Arabs to this day. If you want to go up there and see it, the Israeli tour guide Litch Lucia says, I can't go in there. This is the Arabs are showing this to you now. Moriah means the chosen of Jehovah. Now, some contend that Mount Gerizim is meant, the famous Ebal and Gerizim right around Shechem. Shechem being in the middle of those two mountains where the curses and the blessings of the law were read from the mountains during Moses' time. but that's a minority opinion. Most probably, it's one of the hills of Jerusalem, as Easton's dictionary says. Here Solomon's temple was built, on the spot that had been the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. It is usually included in Zion to the northeast of which it lay. In other words, you say Mount Zion, that would include Mount Moriah, but more precisely, Mount Moriah is to the north and a little bit to the east of Mount Zion, the city of David. We go now to Genesis 22, verses 3 through 5. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son. And he split wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship and return to you." Now, the very next morning, Abraham says, "Let's go." He didn't procrastinate at all. God gave him a horribly difficult command, and Abraham didn't hesitate. He was a man of faith. Just like he left Ur of the Chaldees without hesitation, God said, "Go, Abraham, leave your hometown." And Abraham got up and went. Compare that with Lot. The angel said, "Lot, you need to get out of Sodom because we're about to destroy Sodom." And Lot says, "Well, you know," Lot hesitated. He didn't want to go. Not Abraham. Verse 4 says, on the third day, Abraham saw Mount Moriah. That's how long it took to get from Beersheba to Moriah. It's about 45 miles. And as someone says, I don't have in my notes who it was, but this is a part of the type. Isaac was as good as dead for 3 days. Took 3 days to get up there, Mount Moriah. He's a dead man. And then he rose from the dead from Mount Moriah. That's pretty good. Now in verse 5, Abraham told his young men, his servants, "Stay here with the donkey. I and the lad will go over, and we will worship and return to you." Why did he tell the young men to stay there? Because if Abraham's men had seen Abraham sacrificing Isaac, what do you think they would have done? They would have stopped him. So Abraham told them to cool their heels while he went up alone with Isaac. Now in verse 5, Abraham said, "I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship and return to you." Neither Isaac nor anyone else knew what Abraham had in mind. When Isaac heard worship, he probably thought, "Oh, we're going to go up there and make a sacrifice." He wasn't thinking of himself as being the sacrifice. And notice that Abraham says, "We will return." That would include Isaac, because that's only two people going up there. "We will return," because Abraham did not expect Isaac to remain dead. He expected God to raise him from the dead. Now, when Abraham said, "We will return to you," there's a couple of options how he knew that. John Gill suggests that Abraham was under a spirit of prophecy and Abraham predicted Isaac's return. Most people, on the other hand, say that no, Abraham just had faith that Isaac would rise from the dead. Hebrews 11:17 through 19 backs that idea up. That passage reads this way: "By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, 'In Isaac your descendants shall be called.' He considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type." So here we see the book of Hebrews calling this incident with Isaac on Mount Moriah as a type of the resurrection of Christ. And it explicitly says, Hebrews 11:19, that Abraham believed that God was able to raise people from the dead. So that's what he was thinking when he went up there to sacrifice his only son, Isaac. Now, how is Isaac a type of Christ? Six ways. First, Isaac was Abraham's only son. Jesus was God's only son. Second, Isaac was sentenced to death for 3 days. Jesus was in the tomb, sentenced to death for 3 days. Isaac carried his own wood to his altar. Jesus carried his own cross down the Via Dolorosa. That's the third way. The fourth way that Isaac is a type of Jesus is that his father sacrificed him. Likewise, Jesus' father sacrificed him on the cross. The fifth way that Isaac is a type of Jesus dying is that Isaac was delivered from death off of his altar. Likewise, Jesus was delivered from death out of his grave. The sixth way that Isaac is a type of Jesus, Isaac went to his death without a murmur. And Jesus, like a meek lamb, went to his death without a murmur also. Now, if you believe in types, and of course you have to believe in types, some people get carried away with types. But the types that are so clear as this, these are the types you ought to emphasize. It's obviously Isaac is a type of Jesus. We go now to Genesis 22, verses 6, 7, and 8. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Well, let's stop here at verse 6. Abraham took the wood, probably because the mountaintop was too difficult for the ass to climb up, as John Gill said, so he got Isaac to carry the wood. And of course, Isaac's a lot younger than Abraham. It would be too hard for Abraham, a 100-year-old man, to carry that wood up there. I say 100 years old is 100 plus now. If Isaac was 18, then Abraham was 118. He was getting up there. And Abraham took in his hand the fire. The fire was probably in some kind of a vessel, some kind of a clay pot or something. Took the fire up there. That was to light the sacrifice and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Verse 7, Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, My father. And he said, Here I am, my son. And he, Isaac, said, Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. Isaac's starting to get suspicious. Not suspicious, but he's starting to wonder, where's the sacrifice? And Abraham says, God will provide the sacrifice. And of course, what Abraham was meaning is, you're going to be the sacrifice. So, but I guess he didn't want to break the news to him right there at that point. Now, notice the tender words, my father. Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, my father. That must have cut Abraham pretty deeply, as John Gill says, because Abraham's getting ready to kill him. And then Abraham says, Here I am, my son. And Abraham calls him his son. Again, terms of intimacy, father and son, that adds to the poignancy of this scene. Now, when Isaac asks in verse 7, Where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Obviously, Isaac didn't know he was to be the sacrifice. Question arises, why did Abraham not tell him? Well, if Abraham had told Isaac there at that point, Isaac might not have gone on the journey without putting up a fight. I mean, you know, if I was about to get laid up on an altar and burn up, I might say, hey, Dad, hey, Pops, I'm not going to do that. He might have wanted to fight. So Abraham didn't tell him. And when Abraham said God will provide a lamb for the burnt offering, actually provided a ram that was found in the thicket. So Abraham was exactly right, found in the thicket. Abraham was exactly right. Now, note that this ram that was provided is a different type of Christ. Two types here. You got Isaac as a type of Christ, and you also have the ram as a substitutionary atonement, a substitute for Isaac, dying for Isaac. So the analogy shifts from Isaac as the sacrifice to the ram as a sacrifice. We go now to verses 9, 10, and 11. Then they came to the place of which God had told him, i.e. Mount Moriah. And Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood and bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. The angel of the Lord there, I'm assuming is Jesus. Visible voice, not a visible voice, but an audible voice called to Abraham from heaven. Now, when Abraham bound his son and put him on the altar, why did he bind Isaac? Probably to keep him from running. If you're about to get killed, you're probably going to want to get up and run. And as a matter of fact, all sacrifices were normally bound before they were killed because cows are the same way, and sheep and goats and oxen, they're the same way. They want to run when they're about to get killed. Now, Isaac was most probably, despite the binding here, he's still probably a willing sacrifice because he's being bound. He could have fought off 100-plus-year-old Abraham. He's a young man. Abraham's an old man. He could have fought him off. And remember, there were no servants up there. Abraham had left the servants below. So why did he meekly submit to being tied up and put on the altar? John Gill speculates that Abraham may have convinced him of the necessity to obey God. Abraham might have used these arguments. Hey, God can change his mind at the last minute, Isaac, so you won't die. Or maybe somehow God will prevent the fatal blow from happening. Maybe there'll be an earthquake or something. Or maybe God will rise you from the dead, Isaac. Somehow God convinced Isaac to obey God's command. And Isaac went right along with it. He was a willing sacrifice, which is perfect for the type of Jesus being a willing sacrifice for us. Now here, of course, we need to ask the obvious question, how is it moral for a good God and a righteous Abraham, for that matter, how is it moral for them to consent to human sacrifice? Well, the first thing we need to point out is God didn't consent to human sacrifice. He knew his command was going to be revoked, so he wasn't guilty of human sacrifice. However, Abraham didn't know that. So could we not charge Abraham with, quote, attempted child sacrifice, unquote? Here's the answer. This is according to at least one website I've read. Abraham had perfect faith that God was going to raise Isaac from the dead, and so he was not intending to kill him permanently. Abraham had experience with a miracle-working God. He had already seen Sarah give birth to Isaac miraculously at the age of 90. He had already seen Sodom destroyed in a beautiful day, nothing, no problem. All of a sudden, boom, the whole city's gone. He had already seen a plague come on Egypt to deliver Sarah from the harem when he was down in Egypt in Genesis 12. He'd seen God working over and over again, so he just assumed God was going to work again. And he was talking to Jesus straight from heaven directly. So he didn't expect Isaac to stay dead. That's how you answer the moral problem. Know that the scriptures nowhere even consider this to be a moral problem. In fact, Abraham's act is given high approval. We read in Hebrews 11:17, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It says Abraham had faith in this incident of offering up Isaac. It didn't say he was evil or he had made a moral misstep. James 2:21 says this, was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? So James says Abraham was doing a good work to offer up his son on the altar. So let's don't start saying that God's immoral. As bad as it looks and as horrific as it looks, he was just merely setting up a severe test for Abraham. And Abraham passed the test. May God bless him. That makes up for any indiscretions he might have had about getting Sarah put into two harems. Now, some people ask this question. Was Isaac angry at Abraham for what Abraham had done? Here's an argument that he was angry. If we drop down to verse 19 of Genesis 22, we read this. Abraham went back to his young men, and they got up and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham settled in Beersheba. Isaac is not mentioned in that verse. And so the argument is, Isaac doesn't go back with Abraham. When Abraham went to the young men, no Isaac. When Abraham went back to Beersheba, no Isaac. And so Isaac must have gone off in a huff. Well, that's an argument from silence. And it's not a very good argument, in my opinion, because here's some arguments that Isaac was not angry. Later on in Genesis 24, we see Abraham and Isaac getting along when Abraham sent to Haran to find a wife for him, to find Rebekah. Not a problem. Isaac later lived in Abraham's tent. Not a problem between Abraham and Isaac. Isaac later lived in Abraham's tent, Genesis 24 and verse 67. And Isaac brought her into the tent, brought Rebekah into the tent of his mother Sarah. Well, the tent of his mother Sarah is Abraham's tent. So Isaac still buddy-buddy with his mother Sarah and presumably with Abraham, his father. And last but not least, Isaac actually helped to bury Abraham in Genesis 25:9. His, Abraham's son, Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah near Mamre in the field of Ephron. So Isaac helped bury Abraham. He wasn't mad at his father Abraham. He was a willing sacrifice. We go to Genesis 22, verses 12 through 14. He, that's God, or the angel of Jehovah, said, Jesus said, do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide, or as the King James has it, Jehovah Jireh. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it will be provided. Now in verse 13, Genesis 22, it says, Abraham raised his eyes and looked. Interestingly, one of my commentators, I didn't write his name down unfortunately, says that this was referred to in John 8:56, where Jesus says this, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. And when did Abraham see that day? Is when he saw that ram replacing Isaac on Mount Moriah. When Abraham looked and saw the ram, that's when Abraham rejoiced to see Jesus' day. Well, that's interesting speculation. I don't know if that's what Jesus was referring to. A ram, by the way, is a male sheep. A ewe is a female sheep. This ram was offered in the place of his son. That's a good word for as a substitute for the son, because this is a type of the substitutionary atonement of Jesus Christ. He was substituted in our place so that we wouldn't have to be slain like he was slain because of our sentence of condemnation under sin. Now, Abraham called that place on Mount Moriah, the Lord will provide. That's Jehovah Jireh. You know that old song we used to sing. I used to sing it in college years ago. Jehovah Jireh, my provider. That's what it means. The Lord will provide, my provider. Of course, unfortunately, we sang that song so much in the context of God will provide our material needs, money, when actually what God provided was a sacrifice for the life of Isaac. a substitutionary sacrifice, a little bit more exalted than God providing money. And as it is said to this day, the day that Moses wrote, which is about 400 years later, in the Mount of the Lord it will be provided. Now, it's interesting, that term Mount of the Lord later on became the phrase that was often used to refer to the Temple Mount. This was all during the Israelite monarchy period. For example, Psalm 24:3, who may ascend the hill or the Mount of the Lord? And that's talking about Mount Zion. Isaiah 2:3, and many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the Mountain of the Lord, Mount Zion. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Isaiah 30, verse 29, you will have songs as in the night when you keep the festival, and gladness of heart as when one marches to the sound of the flute to go to the Mountain of the Lord, to the Rock of Israel. The Mountain of the Lord, of course, is just a short way of saying Mount Zion, which is a symbol of Jerusalem, which is a symbol of the people of God. Zechariah 8:3, thus says the Lord, I will return to Zion and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Then Jerusalem will be called the city of truth, and the mountain of the Lord of hosts will be called the holy mountain, the mountain of the Lord, Mount Zion. Mount Moriah, remember, was concluded in the whole area of Mount Zion, even though there was a narrower Mount Zion proper. The idea is that Mount Moriah is called the Mount of the Lord, the mountain of the Lord. And that became a symbol for the people of God. You got the old Zion, which is Israel, and you got the new Zion, which is the church, the people of God. I'm thinking that probably the Israelites called Mount Zion the mountain of the Lord because of what Abraham called it here in Genesis 22. I can't prove it, but I wouldn't be surprised. We go now to Genesis 22, verses 15 through 19. Then the angel of the Lord, that's Jesus, called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord. And that's why we think it's Jesus, because he says, by myself I have sworn. That's divine. Capital M, in fact, the NASB has it, by myself, capital M, I have sworn, declares the Lord. So this is Jesus, who was God, swearing, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. Indeed, I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of heaven, stars of the heavens, and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of your enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth will be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. Now the angel of Jehovah called Abraham a second time from heaven. He's going to basically renew the covenant, as we see from this covenant language here in just a minute. So Abraham exercises an extraordinary amount of faith, and as a result, God responds and renews the covenant with him again. He swore by himself, this angel of Jehovah did. Why? Because there was nothing higher that he could swear by, so he swore by himself. This reminds us of Hebrews 6:13, for when God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself. And, of course, Hebrews 6:13 is probably referring right here to Genesis 22, verse 16, by myself I have sworn. So God made the promise. Again, this is the promise of land, seed, and blessings. He made it to Abraham, and he swore by himself. Verse 17, part of that swearing that God did, that oath that God made, indeed I will greatly bless you. This confirms the promise of blessing that God gave Abraham when Abraham left Haran to go into the promised land, Genesis 12:2-3. And I will make you a great nation, God said, and I will bless you and make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you. And the one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So there's the blessing of Abraham. He's going to be blessed, and he's going to give a blessing. How is this blessing of Abraham fulfilled? Well, physically, it was fulfilled because God created a great nation. That great nation was physically fulfilled in the times of Solomon, 1 Kings 4:21. Solomon ruled all the kingdoms from the Euphrates River, that's over in Syria, to the land of the Philistines, that's over to the Mediterranean, and as far as the border of Egypt, to the Wadi El Arish, that's right there down there, which is the border of Egypt. Wadi El Arish runs right there near Beersheba. They offered tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. So there's the great nation fulfilled physically. And not only was Abraham to have a great nation in his descendants, but also there was going to be blessings to all the nations. That was fulfilled physically under Solomon. The Queen of Sheba came to hear his wisdom. There were many nations that became rich trading with Solomon, and Solomon became a great nation that was not only great in itself, but blessed all the nations of the earth, just like God promises here after Isaac was delivered from his sacrifice. Verse 18, the angel Jehovah calls to Abraham from heaven and says, in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Well, we've already said physically they're blessed because of the physical trade with Solomon and so forth, all those Jews. So that's the physical fulfillment. But the ultimate fulfillment is spiritual, Galatians 3:8. The scripture foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, all the nations will be blessed in you. It means all the nations are going to be blessed because children of Abraham are going to be Christians, and they're going to be Christians everywhere in every nation, which they are to this day. In verse 17, God tells, or the angel of Jehovah tells Abraham that your seed shall be multiplied. I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of heaven, as the sand by the seashore. Well, that was the repetition of a promise earlier given to Abraham. For example, after the separation from Lot, when Abram and Lot were separated there in Hebron, Genesis 13:16, God tells Abraham, quote, I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. There's the sand of the seashore, verse 17. I will multiply your seed as the sand which is by the seashore, and I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven, God tells, the angel of Jehovah tells Abraham on Mount Moriah. Where was that? What is that? A repetition of the promise in Genesis 15:5, when God first cut the covenant with Abraham. And he, God, took him, Abraham, outside and said, now look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you're able to count them. And he, God, said to him, Abraham, so shall your descendants be, like the stars. God repeats that promise here on Mount Moriah, verse 17, Genesis 22. Your seed, I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens, uncountable stars, uncountable Jews, both physical and spiritual. Now this seed, as numerous as the stars and as like the sand of the seashore, is fulfilled literally in the Old Testament. 1 Kings 4:20, Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand that is on the seashore. Uses the same phrase there. They were eating and drinking and rejoicing. So that was fulfilled physically in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, the promise of a numerous offspring as numerous as the sand is fulfilled in Genesis 3:16. Now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. He does not say, and to his seeds is referring to many, but rather to one, and to your seed that is Christ. So Galatians 3:16 fulfills it in seeds, Christians, as well as the original seed, Jesus. We go now to Genesis 22, verses 20 through 24. Now it came about after these things that it was told Abraham, saying, behold, Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor. Nahor's back in Haran in Syria. Uz his firstborn and Buz his brother. How'd you like to have two kids named Uz and Buz? Nahor must have had a sense of humor. And Uz and Buz had a brother and had a brother named Kemuel, who was the father of Aram and Chesed and Hatso and Pildash and Jidlap and Bethuel. The only ones you need to remember here is Aram, because Aram is the father of the Syrians. He's the father of the 12 Aram. Well, Nahor is the father of the 12 Aramean tribes, and Aram gave the name to the Aramites, or the Syrians. In ancient history, Aram is just another name for Syria. In fact, we see the name Aram in the term Aramaic, which is a form of the Syriac language. Aramaic is the language that Jesus probably spoke. It's interesting here that Nahor had 12 kids, so there were 12 Aramean tribes, 8 sons by his wife and 4 by his concubines. Kind of interesting. Coincidence? Maybe not. Nahor, Abraham's brother. Abraham had left Nahor in Ur of the Chaldees. And then when he had left Ur, Abraham went to Haran. Nahor followed him back up to Haran. And so Nahor stayed in Syria there in Mesopotamia. Now, this genealogy was told to Abraham in verse 20. It was told probably by someone coming from their area of Haran, as John Gill says, and told Abraham, this is your family tree. This is what's going on over there. Well, what's the purpose of all this? Well, so Abraham could find a wife for Isaac, because remember, they were pilgrims wandering around in a strange land, sojourning in a strange land, and they didn't have anybody for old Isaac to marry. So that's why this genealogy is inserted here, as John Gill and Adam Clark, I think, correctly say. Now, speaking of Uz and Buz, Nahor's children, Uz gave his name to the land of Uz, where Job dwelt. Job may have been a descendant of Uz. We read in Job 1, verse 1, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And then Job had a brother named Uz had a brother named Buz. And Elihu in the book of Job was from this family. Elihu was the fourth false friend of Job. We read in Job 32:2, but the anger of Elihu, the son of Barachel the Buzite. One more name in this genealogy of Nahor might be interesting is Chesed, from whom it is generally thought sprung the Chaldees, who are commonly called Kastim. But mention is made of the Chaldees before this man was born, unless they are called so by anticipation. In other words, this is a question whether Chesed might refer to the Chaldeans. Now, there's one other person that's mentioned in this genealogy. Bethuel became the father of Rebekah. And, of course, we all know Rebekah. That's Isaac's beautiful wife. We're going to read a lot about Rebekah later on. This is the purpose that this genealogy was included here in Genesis. No mention is made of Rebekah's brother Laban or Rebekah's sister Leah. I don't know why, but they'll show up later. Now, the four sons of the concubine are absolutely unknown. The concubine's name was Rumah, and she bore Teba and Gaham and Tahash and Makkah, and who knows who they are, who cares who they are. You wonder why they were even included. They're not mentioned anywhere else in Scripture. Ladies and gentlemen, we have finished with the famous story of Isaac on Mount Moriah being virtually sacrificed by his father. Not quite. Beautiful type of Christ. We are now prepared to go to our next chapter in Genesis, which is chapter 23. We'll do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 20, which discusses Sarah's death and burial. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.